So I want to talk about Genesis 14 and its time. We'll look at Genesis 14 in a few minutes. But first, I want to prime the pump a bit with some ebbs and flows and consensus. Many of you will know that guy, Julius Wellhausen, who's kind of set the tone for Old Testament critical scholarship in the late 19th century. And he really questioned the historicity of the patriarchal narratives, argued that they were written in a later age and really about a later age, but retrojecting later age things back on an earlier period. By the 1960s, this guy, W.F. Albright, had to some degree undone that consensus, at least in the U.S., and to some degree also in Israel, a few French scholars as well, by arguing, as he says here, aside from a few diehards among older scholars, there's scarcely a single biblical historian who's not been impressed by the rapid accumulation of data supporting the substantial historicity of the patriarchal tradition, which is a pretty remarkable thing to say. And it's quite different from what Wellhausen did say and would have said and some of his students. Fast forward again to the mid-1970s. Some of you may recognize these names. Thomas Thompson, part of the so-called Copenhagen School of Biblical Minimalists, and John Van Cedars. They wrote books in 1974 and 1975, respectively, which in a really wholesale way questioned the historicity of the patriarchal narratives on a number of grounds, among them being personal names, which we at Tyndale House are trying to address, but also on the grounds that there really is no kind of historical basis for the claims that we find there. I will let you look at the handout for these quotes, but I want to bring you forward to the present, or very close to the present, 2 years ago. This is a quote by Christian Frevel, a professor in Bochum in Germany, in his History of Ancient Israel, 2023. The only sources of the patriarchal narratives is the book of Genesis, and what is told there is not to be understood historically, nor is it intended to be understood historically, and that's really important. Nor is it intended to be understood historically. The narratives collected there in clusters of traditions, which according to biblical chronology take place in the first half of the second millennium BC, mainly represent retrojections into the period before the constitution of the states of Israel and Judah. Yet these traditions were themselves only written during the period of these states and later. And he goes on that these traditions, whether oral or written, have preserved historical memories from the Middle Bronze Age, that's the first half of the second millennium BC, and the Late Bronze Age, second half of the second millennium BC. Whether these traditions have preserved historical memories is very unlikely from what comparative ethnology can say about the transmission of collective memories. By denying the historicity of the biblical narratives, they are not devalued, but theologically valorized. And that's a really important point, and I think I would want to set over against that the way that Jesus refers back to the patriarchal narratives, or the way that the apostles refer back to, or for that matter, the way that later Old Testament writers refer back to Genesis and use it. I think this is a very problematic notion. I'm not a theologian. I'm not going to sort of work out the implications of this, but you will all probably be able to intuit some of it. This is the background against which I want to think a bit about the historicity of the patriarchal narratives, from a very kind of data-driven, evidence-driven point of view. And I would love to see this overturned, in one sense, although I'd really love to see people trust Scripture totally, not only because of the evidence, but also because they trust Jesus. So I want to think a bit about some methodological points before we look at the evidence. And this is very important, I think, because when you read Thomas Thompson and John Van Cedars, who've set the tone for the current consensus, in spite of the fact that that was 1974, 1975. It's remarkable. You read Christian Frevel's work, and he's still citing Thompson and Van Cedars that long ago. And you can see this. I was reading a relatively recent commentary on Genesis, a critical commentary on Genesis, and was citing that as well, as if they had really established sort of the facts. But the reality is, I think they've really not dealt with the facts very well at all. And as more facts have emerged, more evidence has emerged over the past decades, that's become even more clear. So one of the things I want to do today is to think about that sort of evidence. Before we go to it, I want to think a bit about how we interpret the evidence. The reality is that evidence doesn't come to us and get used objectively, does it? We all interpret the evidence. And so it's important to bear a few things in mind about the about historical evidence. And here I'm thinking about kind of the practice of historical reconstruction. So we take records, documents, and so on from the past, but also archaeological evidence and so on. And then we could try to reconstruct a historical narrative, what happened in the past. One of the things that I regularly run into when I try to reconstruct the past on the basis of the text that I study as an Assyriologist, I study ancient Mesopotamia, is just the fact that we have a tiny fraction of the evidence of the past that once existed. And that slide with the tip of the iceberg sticking up is very, very appropriate. In fact, you might almost push the iceberg down so that there's very little sticking above the water. The reality is that the amount of material that was undoubtedly produced in the past, textual material, for example, of that material, very little is likely to have been preserved. And moreover, our historical evidence is randomly and irregularly preserved. So if you look at the long durée, the whole kind of period of Mesopotamian history, for example, let's say 3000 BC to 400 BC, depending on when you cut it off, what you find is that some periods are much better represented in the textual evidence than others. We have what we call Dark Ages, for example, after 1595 BC, kind of the third quarter of the second millennium BC. And the reality is it isn't dark to them. It's not historically dark. In fact, it's simply that our evidence is scant. We can't see it. So we mean something about ourselves rather than about the past. Whereas the preceding period, what we call the Old Babylonian period, the first half of the second millennium BC, is copiously evidenced. So we have tens of thousands of documents from that period. But even then, we have documents from certain cities and not others, right? So it can be, it's very clear that our evidence is randomly and irregularly preserved. Part of the randomness is to do with the deposition of the evidence, right? So if you think about cuneiform texts, ancient documents, they are dug up out of archaeological excavations. Archaeological excavations are, of necessity, destruction layers of some kind. Maybe not by conquest, but somehow the city has decayed or has been destroyed and built upon, and that preserves the documents that are available to us. And that is a random fact in one sense, I mean, apart from providence. But the reality is that we can't sort of predict where the evidence will be and when it will be preserved. The evidence also has to be correctly interpreted, and this is very, very important. A number of kind of reconstructions of things like the Israelite conquest of Canaan or of the patriarchal narratives have been essentially modern models to explain disparate data. And over time, it can be the case that the models are confused with the data, such that scholars like Thompson and Van Cedars think that when they deconstruct the model, they've deconstructed the idea that the data indicate anything historical in Scripture. And the same is true to some degree for the conquest stories as well as the patriarchal stories. But the reality is that the evidence needs to be interpreted correctly in order to understand what it indicates, what it signifies. So this is maybe a bit of a shocking claim, but we can neither confirm nor falsify the vast majority of historical claims in the Old Testament. And what I mean by that is that we can't sort of go back and find a document that says Abraham left Ur of the Chaldeans to go to Canaan and then Egypt. There's no such document, to my knowledge, around. And you will find claim after claim after claim in the biblical text like that, in the New Testament, but especially in the Old Testament. And the reason, I think, is not a problem with the Old Testament text, but rather the distribution of our evidence. We simply can't confirm or falsify the vast majority of these claims because of a weakness in the historical method, in one sense. This is an old thing that Kenneth Kitchen liked to say quite a lot: absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. But it's really both catchy and true. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So be very leery of arguments that say there is no evidence that this occurred, therefore it did not occur. That is highly problematic. I mean, purely on logical grounds, really? I mean, think about that. But particularly given the distribution of our evidence, it becomes very problematic. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Now, one could potentially make a case where the absence of evidence in a context where there's lots of evidence otherwise about other things, when there's absence of evidence within that of an event, you might be able to build an argument that such an event did not occur. Even then, I'm really quite cautious. We ought to bear this in mind. And then another thing to bear in mind, I think in particular about Genesis 14 that I want to talk about later, is just the fact that there are levels of historical depth in the Bible. So what do I mean? One of the things that the Bible refers to is events that occurred in the past. And if you read the rest of the Bible, you'll see that the Bible itself regards those accounts as being historical, or as meaning to be historical, let's say. Those historical accounts are meant to be read as telling us things that happened. So it's the time the events occurred. But then there's the level of the time the sources were composed and or edited. Now, I'm not talking about a sort of anything along the lines that Wellhausen proposed, although the reality is it's very clear that scripture, that Genesis, for example, is written from a later perspective. Regardless of who you think wrote it or whatever, it's written from a later perspective. Now, I don't want to get into the weeds about sort of what that perspective is and when. I think we need to stick very carefully to the evidence that we find in the Bible on that subject. But the point is, there's a difference between the time the events occurred and the time the sources were composed, and that will bear on how we interpret the sources. What I want to argue is that the Bible's claims about the past are at least compatible with the evidence that we have. So for the most part, I think entirely, I'm not going to say this proves the patriarchal narratives are true, because I don't think the evidence that I'm going to present to you do that. Now, evidence could emerge that do prove in the sense that we usually mean in historical studies. That's possible. In fact, given the fact that I think it happened, it's entirely possible. We shouldn't rule it out. But the reality is we need to be honest, frank, about what the evidence we have really indicates. This is part of being truthful, I think, as Christians. We are committed to the truth, committed to the facts. And while Scripture is true, we need to be truthful about the evidence around Scripture as well. Another way of saying this is that the Bible's claims about the past are at least plausible. And I want to present evidence along these lines, right? It's a sort of toned-down version of sort of proving the text to be true. So for this part, I just want to actually look over Genesis 14. So if you want to get a Bible out, that's fine. I'm going to read the text here. I put the ESV in English beside it. If you prefer a different language, that's fine. And we can look at the Hebrew text, and I'll point a few things out as we go. So it happened in the days of Amraphel. You can see my, yeah. In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Kedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinov, king of Admah, and Shem-Aver, king of Tzvoim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. It's a very interesting thing to say. That king's name isn't given to us, but his town is. And Zoar has been mentioned in chapter 13 in the previous chapter. Here we're given what appears to be an older name for the same town, Bela, and the text is clarifying for us another name for it. I want to argue, actually, that Zoar is a later name, precisely because in chapter 19, the name is changed. So we know it's a later name from that point of view. So the text does use later names for kind of earlier towns, for towns that would have been called something different in Abraham's time. Again, there's a distinction here between when the texts are composed and when these events occurred. All these were united together to the Valley of Siddim, that is, the Sea of Salt. Again, it's clarifying what the Valley of Siddim is. 12 years they served Kedorlaomer, and the 13th year they rebelled. And in the 14th year came Kedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, and they struck Rephaim in Ashtaroth Karnaim, and the Zuzim in Ham, and the Amim in Shaveh Kiriathaim, and the Horite in their hill country Seir, as far as El Paran, which is beside the desert, let's say. And they turned and they entered or came to Ein Mishpat, that is Kadesh. Notice again, the text is clarifying these names, probably bringing them up to date to kind of new readers. And they struck all the field, literally, of the Amalekite, the kind of region, the lands of the Amalekite. And also the Amorite that was dwelling in Chatzatzon Tamar. Now, the king of Sodom went out, the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah went out, and the king of Admah and the king of Tzvoim and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, and they arranged with them for battle in the valley of Siddim. Kedorlaomer, with Kedorlaomer, the king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, and Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, 4 kings with 5. I just want to notice here that in verse 1, if you look back in verse 1, the text refers to this, sets this in the time of the days of Amraphel and Arioch first. They're the first two in the list in verse 1. Here and later on, it's Kedorlaomer. And then later on, we're going to see Kedorlaomer and the kings who were with them. So one of the things I want to look at later from the evidence is, do we have a setting in which Elam is actually leading kings like this and over into the Levant? This is going to be the main thing we discuss later. But you can see the priority of Kedor LaOmer as we read the text. So verse 10. The valley of Siddim was wells or springs, springs of pitch or bitumen. And the king of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and they fell there. Probably fell doesn't mean die, because we see the king of Sodom coming back later in the chapter. Fall can mean something more innocuous than that. And the remainder to the hill country fled. And they took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food, and they left. And also they took Lot and his possessions, the son of the brother of Abram, and they went. Now he was dwelling in Sodom. Bit of a drum roll there, right? So Abram and Lot separate in chapter 13, and Lot ends up near Sodom, goes near Sodom, and now he's in Sodom. Now a survivor came, and he reported to Abram the Hebrew. That's very important. That's probably a marker of age. I can talk about that later if you ask me a question about it, but I don't have time now. He was dwelling in, by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, the brother of Eshcol and the brother of Aner, and they were literally lords of a covenant of Abram. So they were allied together. And Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, and he literally emptied his retainers, the men born of his house, 318, and he pursued as far as Dan. Now that's important. We know that Dan's name was changed later, right, in Judges 18. So I guess Pete will talk about that maybe in some morning talk. So Dan's name is changed from Laish to Dan, right, by the Danites when they moved there centuries later. So the use of Dan here seems to be kind of from a later point of view. He divided himself against them by night, he and his servants, and he struck them, and he pursued them as far as Hovah, which is to the left, literally, which is north, right? You face east, left is north, which is to the north, north of Damascus. And he brought back all the possessions, and also Lot, his brother, and his possessions he brought back, and also the women and the people. Now the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from striking Kedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. Now Kedorlaomer is the priority here. He's the guy, the main guy, and the other kings are with him. So the king of Sodom goes out to the valley of Shaveh. It is the valley of the king. And Melchizedek, the king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was priest to El Elyon, God Most High. And he blessed him, and he said, "Blessed be Abram by El Elyon, by God Most High, maker maybe of heaven and earth, or possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be El Elyon, God Most High, who has probably delivered your enemies into your hands." And he gave to him, Abram gave to Melchizedek, a tenth of all. Now the king of Sodom said to Abram, notice he's back in the picture here, so it felt like Sodom came out to meet Abram. Abram kind of passed him up and went to Melchizedek and dealt with him and gave him some things and received some things from him, including a blessing. Now Sodom is back. He sort of chased Abram down, and now he speaks to him. The king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give to me the people, literally the soul, and the possessions take for yourself." But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have raised my hand to Yahweh, God Most High, the maker or possessor of heaven and earth." This is an oath form, right? So that I will not take either a thread or the strap of a sandal from all that belongs to you, so that you will not say, "I made Abram rich." So Abram wants nothing to do with Sodom, unlike Lot, except only what the young men have eaten, or the servants have eaten, and the portion of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, they will take their portion. So I've emphasized in the text the fact that Kedorlaomer is kind of the chief guy in this coalition. Now there's a lot in this text that we could look at. But I want to briefly look at this notion of Elam being at the head of these powers. So we have Kedorlaomer of Elam. This is a good Elamite name. It means Kudur Lagomar. So the deity Lagomar is a shepherd in Elamite. It's not attested in this form, but Kudur as a word in a name is attested, and Lagomar as a word in a name is attested. They're just not attested together. Tidal of Goyim, It's usually related to Hittite kings of, of the name Tiltrochalia. There are lots of those, particularly beginning in the middle of the second millennium and beyond. What's less well known, and you probably won't find in the biblical commentaries, is that the name is actually attested in what's called the Old Assyrian period, the documents from Kanish, from the 19th century BC in Turkey. So we have that attested, even though we can't necessarily connect it with a guy, a person. Amraphel of Shinar is still a problem. Amraphel is kind of vaguely Amorite-looking, so possibly it's a development of something like Amut-Piel or Amud-Piel, who was a king of Katna, which is a city further north in Syria, in the Levant. So that would mean something like the mouth of God is true, Amat, Amut, so like related to Emet in Hebrew, or Amud-Piel, maybe the mouth of God is a support. I'm not convinced of those. Possibly it's from some unattested name as well, something like Yamur-Piel, the mouth of God has spoken, which kind of fits semantically. But it's really up in the air. There's Arioch of Elasar. We actually have a name spelled Ariuuk, which is very similar to what we have in Arioch. That's been long known, actually, in the literature. It occurs in the Mari text in the 18th century BC. It's probably from Hurrian. So since this was recognized about a century ago, we know Hurrian better than then. And we can say it's probably from a root meaning to give. It's difficult to analyze otherwise. It's worth noting that there is an Arioch in Daniel 2. And what I want to suggest is that Arioch is actually a kind of false friend. It's not really etymologically connected to the Arioch here in Genesis. It's probably Iranian, and a plausible Iranian derivation can be assigned to it. My aim here, as I said, is not to sort of prove these patriarchal narratives true. You already believe they're true on the grounds of the work of the Spirit, on the testimony of the church, of Jesus in particular, the testimony of the apostles. You have good evidence. You've probably studied the evidence some yourself, and you can see how that connects. What I want to do is further encourage you to trust the text with some more circumstantial evidence, which is really all we can give, and also which really usually doesn't end up in the commentaries. So what I'm going to show you, I haven't found it in the commentaries. I'm going to show you some things from the well-known city of Mari on the Euphrates, which you can see there on the map. You can see the Jordan River and the Sea of Galilee and all of it on the left with Israel and the Mediterranean Sea. This is quite far away, but at Mari, about 20,000 cuneiform tablets from about the 18th century BC have been discovered since kind of the first quarter of the 20th century AD. Archaeologists have been digging there and bringing these tablets back, and they've been clarifying some of the kind of historical context of the patriarchs. Here are some examples of some clay tablets. It's the sort of thing they dig up. Actually, more often than not, they're more broken than that. Those are some nicely preserved ones. And that one on the left side is a legal document, I think. You can see a list of witnesses on it. I think the same is true for the right side. These are both legal texts, which is fairly common. They're everyday documents, and they give us insight into sort of the everyday lives of the people living there. But remarkably, the king of Mari was interconnected all over the Near East, including as far as Hatzor in the Levant. And so it's possible to have some insight into things going on around the Near East, not just at Mari. So I'm going to show you a few things from that kind of point of view. Here I just want to show you and just acquaint you briefly with a bit of the geography that we just read about in Genesis, showing you the kind of the north of Canaan. There's the Sea of Galilee, and that brown line right there, this line here beginning with 10, is the route that was taken by by Kedorlaomer and the allies with him. And you can see some of those place names mentioned in the text, Ashtaroth, for example, Rephaim, Karnaim, and so on. The route continues on down. This is all in the Transjordan, on the opposite side of the Jordan, to the Dead Sea region, passing to the east of the Dead Sea and further on south, probably as far as the Gulf of Aqaba, which is where people think El Paran is. It may not be. But the text does say that they turned and went back north, and that's what seems to have happened down here in this in the south. And they go back north to Ein Mishpat, which is clarified in the text as Kadesh. Later on, it will be called Kadesh Barnea. The Israelites stop there during their wanderings and so on. And then they continue on to Chatzaton Tamar, just called Tamar here on the map, where the Amorites are, and then to the Valley of Siddim, which is where this battle happens between the Elamite, between Kedorlaomer and his allies, and these Canaanite kings, Sodom and Gomorrah, and so on. It's worth just noting that Abram is here around Hebron, Mamre, when he hears, and he seems to pursue north, going up north of Damascus. Here's Damascus. You see Tu Hovah right there, and with his 318 men, plus Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre. Presumably, they took people with them as well. They come on Kedorlaomer and his people by night. It's difficult to know whether it's the whole army of this coalition or maybe just an offshoot of the army. There's a lot we don't know, to emphasize what I've said earlier. And then Abram comes back over in the in the Cisjordan, on the western side of the Jordan. We know that because he comes through this region called Shalem in the text. And if you really look in Psalm 76, you'll see Shalem is in parallel to Zion, right? So it suggests that Shalem is Jerusalem, and that fits quite nicely with the element Shalem, Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim, in the place named Jerusalem. And then if you look in later manuscripts, later Jewish sources also gloss this as Jerusalem as well. So that's the geographical context that we're thinking of. I want you to notice in particular, we're talking about sort of northern Canaan as well as southern Canaan. It's where these people are going back to, and we're talking about Damascus and north, which is makes sense because these people would have come from quite far north and east. I want to start this part of the discussion with a quote from Klaus Westermann in his massive commentary, and three-volume commentary in English at least, on Genesis. A punitive expedition of a coalition of four empires, Elam, Babylon, Hatti, and a fourth, against five city kings is historically improbable, if not inconceivable. Now, I want to focus on historically improbable, if not inconceivable, later on, but there are a number of problems with that claim. For example, they're empires. Not true. I mean, even by kind of colloquial definitions of empires, they're not kind of states made up of lots of different cultures that they're controlling in a kind of network with laws and a system of government and maintenance and so on. These are medium-sized regional states, apart possibly from Elam. So the notion of an empire sort of scares us and makes us think, well, why would they be bothering about these little city-states? But that's really not a helpful way to characterize what's going on here. So one of the things I want to do is just sort of look at the major states in the period, and I want to think about sort of what we're dealing with. What do we actually have? So here's yet another map. I really like maps, as you can see. This is a period from kind of 1792 to 1775 BC. The kind of highlighted areas, we call it the Kingdom of Upper Mesopotamia, and it was ruled by a king called Shamshi-Adu, my son is Adu, my S-U-N is Adu, is what his name means. And he kind of conquers this region. He comes from over here in Ekalatum on the Tigris River, this place here, and he kind of conquers this whole region, and when he's conquered everything he wants, he sets up one of his sons, Yasmach-Adu, here at Mari. And he sets up another one of his sons here at Ekalatum, Ishme-Dagon, and then he sets up his own state, his own capital at Shubat-Enlil in the north up there. So you have this kind of triad of capitals. And some of the evidence that we're going to look at is to do with this son, Yasmach-Adu, and Mari. He's kind of a wimp, apparently. At least his dad thought so, and he constantly bothered him about it. It's a very interesting thing. Ishme-Dagon, by the way, means Dagon heard Ishme, like Shema in Hebrew. Right? And that's Akkadian, the language of Mesopotamia in the south. That's one of Shamshi-Adad's sons. His other son has an Amorite name, Yasmach-Adu. It's the same root, Adu heard, like Shema. So he's kind of called both his sons in separate languages, named them in separate languages, and yet they call themselves Amorites. They regard themselves as Amorites, which connects quite nicely with what we saw about Mamre. Now, this kingdom existed from about 1792 to about 1775 BC, and then Shamshi-Adad died. And his sons, as is often the case with these sorts of setups, couldn't hold on to the kingdom. And what had happened is, when Shamshi-Adad had taken over this whole region, he came to the city of Mari, and he sent the native house of Mari, the native royalty of Mari, up to Yamhad, up there, to Aleppo, in exile. The king that he sent there was called Zimri-Lim, and he was sort of waiting, essentially, for Shamshi-Adad to die and these sons to get weak so he could come back out of exile and retake his capital at Mari and potentially also retake this whole region. Now, you can imagine that when a kingdom this size goes away, it creates a power vacuum. This happens repeatedly in history, right? And so when that happens, people around want a piece of it. And so what happens, essentially, is that Elam, which is over here, the Elamites over in Iran, is the most powerful power of the time. All of the other kingdoms around in this region, which I'll show you in a minute, regard Elam as more significant. They regard themselves as sons of Elam, for example. And so Elam defeats Eshnunna, which is kind of in this region, and then pushes west into this kind of upper Mesopotamian region that you see portrayed here, and begins to take things over quite far west, possibly as far as the Euphrates. And then, as we're going to see, begins to interact with the king of Cutna down here about starting to take things over also further down in the Levant, potentially as far as Hazor in the south further down here. That puts us in range, in striking range, of what we find in Genesis 14. Here's Elam. So we've got the Persian Gulf here. This is Sumer and Akkad, the sort of Babylonian region. And Elam is this eastern power adjacent to Sumer and Akkad. And you can see these major cities of Susa and Anshan. So the Elamites had a kind of, a kind of bipolar kingdom with two capitals. And they had rulers at each place called Sukal or Sukal Mach. It's Sumerian for vizier and grand vizier. And we know the names of these grand viziers. Unfortunately, none of them is Kedorlaomer. That would be great if it was. But we don't find that name in the evidence at all. But this gives you a sense of how far it must be from Canaan. Elam's all the way over here. And it begins to take an interest in this region with the power vacuum, and then begins to push further to the west with Cutna. Now, just a brief point about this, and then we'll stop looking at maps for the moment. These are kind of the major powers after kind of Elam is eventually kicked out. You can see Babylon, that's Hammurabi's Babylon, the black stela in the Louvre, the law code. Eshnunna in this region, the blue. Assyria, that's a misnomer, it shouldn't be called Assyria, but somebody did that and didn't know it, I guess. And then there's Mari, which is a sort of upper Mesopotamian region that they end up sort of controlling all this region. There's the darker blue, the kingdom of Yamqad, which is centered on modern-day Aleppo. Halab is what it was called at that time. And then further down, the kingdom of Cutna, with the city of Cutna as its kind of capital. And you can see it extends all the way down to Hazor, and we're in the edge of Canaan now. When the Elamites had sort of moved into upper Mesopotamia and started filling the power vacuum up there and began to push farther west, I mentioned that the king of Cutna, further down along the coast of the Mediterranean, wanted the Elamites to come and take over that region. And here is the textual evidence for that. Now, in one sense, this is very interesting. In another sense, it shows you how scant our evidence can be and how difficult to interpret it can be. Now, this is a letter written by Ami Shagish, who is an officer of Zimri-Lim in Mari. He's stationed at the kingdom at Yamqad. He's stationed here in Halab, and he's from here. And the text that I was just showing you is a letter he sent back to his master to tell his master goings-on over in this region and what was happening, right? So that's kind of the background. The text reads, "To my lord," that's Zimri-Lim and Mari, "thus speaks Ami-Shagash, your servant, when an Elamite messenger passed from Amar to Aleppo, he sent three of his servants to Cutna. Hammurabi of Yamqad heard about this," that's the king of Yamqad, "heard about this and sent to his border." He has a border, his southern border was with Cutna. So he sent these messengers to his border, and they seized those men, these Elamite messengers, when they were coming back from Cutna. And they intercepted their missive. They said, "The ruler of Cutna has sent us to say to our master, to the Elamite king, the land is given over to your hands. Come up. If you come up, you will not be conquered." So this is the king of Cutna inviting the king of Elam, king of Cutna here, inviting the king of Elam to come and take control of essentially the region around Cutna. Now, there is more evidence than that, but that's the clearest example that I know of, and it demonstrates pretty clearly, I think, that Elam had an interest in that far west. Now, it should be said that there is no evidence that the Elamites ever had interests in the Levant in any other period of biblical history other than this period of kind of the 18th century BC. So it's quite striking if Genesis, for example, is written, let's say, in the Persian period, and it gets this right. How would it do that? How would it know to do that? Remarkable thing. The other question is sort of, can we have campaigns in this region from Mesopotamia and so on, right? Were the Mesopotamians, were these so-called empires that Westermann mentioned, were they really interested in things going on in kind of Canaan and nearby regions? Well, I think they were, but I cannot demonstrate that they were as far south as Genesis 14 portrays. So again, this is me not trying to prove what's there in the text. I'm simply saying the conditions were right for what you find in Genesis 14 to have happened. I cannot connect it with a particular event. So this is an example of a set of texts that were written back and forth between Yasmach Adu, that wimp of a king, son, that Shamshi Adad set up at Mari. He's interacting. Sorry, one of his generals is sending back a letter as he's on campaign in the Bekaa Valley, the Bekaa Valley being this region between the Lebanon and anti-Lebanon mountains, right? So here's Beirut. So these guys are on campaign in this region, probably around Baal Bek, south of the Lake of Homs down here, very close to, here's the Sea of Galilee, the Golan Heights, and so on. So we're very close to Canaan, right? So the king of Mari is receiving a letter from one of his generals who is on campaign in that region, and he's there to support the king of Katna, the land just to the north that I was mentioning earlier. And the text reads, Ishchi Adu, that is the king of Katna, led us to the shore of the Homs Lake. I don't know if you sort of have a map of modern Syria in your head, Syria and Lebanon in your head, but you can sort of see this unfolding. Ishri Adu, I'll show you in a minute on an actual map, led us to the shore of the Homs Lake. Later, he brought us around to the valley in the midst of Sirion and Lebanon. You may recognize those names from the Bible, right? The Bible refers to Sirion, particularly Hermon is called Sirion in Scripture. And then Lebanon is also referred to as a source of cedar, right? So he brought us around to the valley in the midst of Sirion and Lebanon, and we surrounded the city of Tzerum. We don't know where that is. For 2 days, we wielded weapons and the city was at peace, meaning they defeated it. He brought out the garrison, probably the king of Tzerum, brought out the garrison and hostages. And then 4,000 men were assembled from Lebanon and Sirion without deliberation. In fervor, they passed before us and came to the aid of the city of Tzivat, which is almost certainly the city of Zovah in Scripture, in the Bible. It's the earliest mention of that city. Saul and David, I think, fight against Zovah. 100 men were assembled to the heart of that city and defended it fervently. At mealtime, we drew near to that city, and Ishchi Adu said, do battle with them. And when the army drew near, the city was seized. What was inside it was brought out, and he took them. He drew near to the city of Razachum, and the army opened the city. Ishchi Adu took its spoil. We drew near to the city of Yasitrum. Now, those are not necessarily recognizable place names to you, perhaps, and that's perfectly understandable. But if we just have a look at a map here, we have the city of Katna right here. So that is the kingdom that the Mari army would have been helping. They were rivals of the kingdom of Yamchad, centered on Aleppo up here, and there would have been a border between them somewhere here. So this army from Mari came over, and they went on campaign with the king of Katna, beginning at Katna probably, and then continuing on down to the Lake of Homs here, probably passing Kadesh. And it's entirely possible, one scholar argues, that Zovah in this text, or Tzibat, is Baal Bek, modern Baal Bek. Maybe one or two of you have been there. There's some Roman ruins on it now, some monumental Roman ruins. I don't think it's ever been dug underneath those, but it was an important city at the time. And then our letter showed that they were going to a series of towns around Baal Bek, a series of four. Tzibat was the second in the series, and they continued on. Now, it seems likely that the final town was probably in the region around Damascus, which at that time was called Appam. And so that puts them very close to Dan and kind of northern Canaan. Now, we know from administrative documents and letters that other people, that various armies were involved in this campaign. Not only the king of Katna and his army, but also 6,000 men from Eshnunna came. Eshnunna was quite far over into Mesopotamia along the Tigris River. 10,000 men from Shamshi Adad of Shubat Enlil, that's in northern Mesopotamia, that greenish area that I showed you earlier. And then 5,000 men from Mari, from Yasmach Adu. So this is a coalition of armies with their generals, led by the king of Katna, on this campaign to the south near Canaan. It's not entirely clear that they got into Canaan. They clearly know about things going on in Canaan. There's another letter that refers to the town, the final town that they were in. And it refers to some Canaanites actually living there. It's the earliest reference to Canaanites that we have. Very interesting. So, I just want to stop there. I think that's probably a good place to stop. I could go on. Quite a lot of other things are in this story in Genesis 14 are old. But let me just recap real quick. Again, I'm not trying to prove that Genesis 14 corresponds to the events I've just showed you. I can't demonstrate that. Maybe they do, but I can't demonstrate that. But what I can say is that the circumstantial evidence supports or agrees with what we see actually in Genesis 14. Mesopotamian kings and coalitions of them were interested in things Canaanite and Levantine. I can demonstrate that on other grounds as well as the text that I've showed you here. We have letters between Mari and Hatzor and so on. But then also the role of Elam, right? The presence of Elam. And at no other point in Near Eastern history is Elam over this far, and does it have this much power in Mesopotamia over Mesopotamia? So it's a striking correlation, particularly when you consider these two facts alongside a cluster of other what appear to be older features in Genesis 14 and the patriarchal narratives more generally. It suggests that at the level of what Genesis 14 is telling us about, the events, it fits very nicely in this kind of 18th century BC window, give or take, I don't know, a century or two or whatever.